Welcome to Soft Strength. My name is Aisha Fakhro, and together we'll explore conversations around humanity, holistic wellness, and mental health to expand our perceptions and the way we experience the world. I'm a firm believer in inherent goodness being the essence of our human nature. And so one question that has really baffled me over the years is how violence is so frequently resorted to in situations of conflict when it's just completely against our essential nature as humans. So I'm really happy and honored to introduce you to this episode's guest. I have the absolute pleasure of talking to Lena from Search for Common Grounds. She has been working in the field of peace building for over 2 decades and has extensive experience and wisdom from her work all over the world. We explore developing an understanding of what internal needs and patterns lead people to resort to such means of unthinkable violence and how we can use that understanding to create a more compassionate world where violence no longer becomes an option and where peace and collaboration can actually be a possibility and a reality. So here is my conversation with Lena. I really look forward to hearing your reflections. Lena, thank you so much for joining me. I'm really excited to have you on today.
You're welcome. I'm excited too, Aisha. It's a pleasure.
So just to explain to the listeners, you are the senior vice president of the largest peacebuilding organization in the world. Can you walk us through how you even found your way to that kind of work to begin with?
Yeah, sure. So I think I knew from a very young age that I wanted to be part of a global community. I can remember even in high school, being the person who would talk to the sort of weirdly dressed exchange students and make friends with them when no one else wanted to. And I also felt that I had a sense of wanting to be active in problems that I came to know about. So whether it was, we need to do a blood drive at the school or we need to try and raise money to fight against homelessness, I felt that sense of like wanting to be part of trying to find a solution. And when I went into university, I very much from an early stage, I directed my studies towards what I most cared about in the world. And then as I became to understand more about what was happening in Africa and particularly apartheid, I became really, really focused and active in the anti-apartheid movement at Stanford University and continued to direct my studies towards that. And these experiences from being part of, seeing history take place with the end of the Cold War and then being active in anti-apartheid work really gave me a sense that, change can happen and we can be part of this. And so I stepped into journalism a little bit by accident. I had been helping someone fundraise for an anti-apartheid newspaper in South Africa while I was at Stanford and basically said, I want to go and help. And I got myself there and I became first a copy editor and then a journalist and then a correspondent. And so for about 10 years, I worked with either anti-apartheid newspapers. I then went to West Africa and worked with independent newspapers that were covering issues from a social justice perspective that were facing the African continent. And after about 10 years doing that work in South Africa and in West Africa, I felt as though there was, more that could be done to particularly contribute to building peace. And I didn't really know what this looked like. When I had come to South Africa in the 90s, I was in the most war-affected province of the country, KwaZulu-Natal province, where there was this war between ANC and Inkatha. And I was covering that. I ended up doing some work as a human rights activist. And it really made me feel as though the devastation that war brings on people is the most important issue in the world. So it was in the year 2000 that I started to look around to try and find some organizations, heard of Search for Common Ground, wrote to them and said, listen, I have media skills. I know how to do different things with arts and culture, with different communities. Is there any way I can help? And what started with me reaching out to them as a volunteer ended up me getting hired, and here I am 19 years later, still with them.
Wow, that's incredible. You start your TEDx talk, which I'll actually link in the show notes for everyone listening to watch, with a sentence that I found really powerful, which is, let me actually read it so I don't change your words here, but you said, "What if I told you we have a vaccine to save lives, but are not using it?" And to me, that sentence is just mind-blowing. And it's kind of where I wanted to begin, because like it's a lot easier to look away than to actually have these conversations. And I was wondering what it was that you saw in doing this work that made it worth actually continuing to look at this instead of seeking the comfort of pretending it doesn't exist.
Yeah, thank you, Aisha, for that question. You know, when I came to the decision that that's how I wanted to start the TED Talk, I felt an accumulation of emotions about the insights that I'd been gaining over the decades of doing this work. On the one hand, I felt an impatience, as though, hold on, we know how to prevent these wars. We know how to enable people to not have violence as an option, and we're not doing it. And feeling as though, why is it that more people don't see this and don't come to understand this? And then I also had a feeling of compassion and empathy, and recognizing that whether you're embroiled in violent conflict or you're looking at it from afar, it seems intractable. It seems too complicated, too hard, impossible to move beyond who was right and who was wrong. And so I really felt like, how can I break this idea down in a simple way that both calls upon us deep down to say, we can do something about this if we understand it differently, and also, how can we break it down in as simple human terms so that it will feel within reach for people to say, huh, I think I can also be part of doing something about this.
Because usually it's a feeling of, where do we even begin?
I think one of the first steps is to get closer. You know, I talked about my own experience of when I went to South Africa, deciding to, at a point in time when most of the architecture of apartheid was still in place, to live in a Black African township. And the experiences of becoming closer to people made me realize how much we can allow ourselves to be guided by judgment or a sense of a perception that is inaccurate if we don't get closer. And as I stepped more into the work as a peace builder, seeing this work around the world, I also could see that the conflict will reinforce itself and remain intractable if people don't take a step closer, suspend their judgment for a moment, and really try and understand what is going on with that other person or that other group. What is it that has made them feel as though they're doing the right thing? Because whether it's in family conflicts or whether it's in international conflicts, people who are choosing or advocating or supporting violence, they really believe they're doing the right thing. And if we don't get closer and listen and understand, I'm convinced that change actually can't happen at all.
What you said just reminded me of a quote by Brené Brown. She talks about how people are really hard to hate close up, but you just have to have the courage to be willing to lean in and step in closer. And I want to share my personal story of how I found my way into this work. I know I shared this with you as well, but for the listeners to maybe experience, because it was so easy for me to look away and to think of extreme violence as something done by the other. It was always people in other countries, other continents, and I always thought, well, they're probably not educated. They probably have no idea. And so it was always the other. And I always had these categories of people and how they were different than who we were. And that's why the violence was happening. Until I heard a story of a girl from my country who had disappeared and was thought to join a violent extremist group. And this was, I think, about 4 years back. And I remember thinking, no, this doesn't happen to people from my country. We're educated here. It doesn't make sense. And so that was so upsetting for me because I could no longer look away, because this was when I realized that there is no profile for violent extremism. I wonder if you could speak more to that. And if there is no profile, what is it that's going on underneath that?
Yeah, no, I think that I've seen similar underlying motivations for people joining armed groups, extremist organizations, violent extremist organizations. And what's been really striking to me to see this across cultures and nations and different socioeconomic groups is that it really comes back to how people's fundamental needs are not always being met. And when we remind ourselves of what those needs are, for needs like being accepted, being loved, but also wanting to feel powerful, wanting to feel a sense of agency, autonomy, feeling as though one can make a difference. These are things that inspire people to decide to go and fight with these organizations because their needs are not being met in their communities or in their families or in relationship between themselves as a citizen and their government. And so when people are drawn into these movements because they're given a sense that by doing so, you can be that powerful, admired, accepted, embraced, loved, powerful person, then once we understand that, it helps us to also understand, how do we transform this dynamic? You know, is it about demonizing and judging the acts that they've committed that will help? And the answer to that, Aisha, is no. In fact, we're often very counterproductive if we step into these conflicts with a sense of righteousness and judgment, as though I'm the holder of knowledge and these are ignorant people who haven't understood the consequences of their choices. In many instances, they have. And so in order to try and transform that, it needs to be about connecting with what people's needs really are and reforming and reframing and healing the relationships between these people and those around them that can really help them to make a new choice. You know, in my TED talk, I talk about the courage to connect, the empathy to ask why, and then helping people to change without humiliating them. And I really believe that for people who've decided to choose violent extremist movements or supporting and promoting them, that these are the steps that can really help us to enable these people to see that they can make another choice, which is also right for them and their needs.
I love how you talk about this also from the perspective of, if you think of coming into this, you know, dialogue with the idea of I'm right and I'm going to win and I need to convince the other that I'm right and to listen to me, it's not going to work, because if you win, the other person loses, and nobody likes to lose.
I think that what you've said is very critical, and it sounds so simple. But when we're in a conflict and we're trying to find a way through it and we feel as though we are going to lose something, we immediately are overtaken by fear for losing our reputation, maybe fear for losing some of the material things that we think we're going to gain. And that doesn't help us to be able to engage. And also, when we get to peace agreements or mediated agreements where one side feels as though they've lost, they're not going to defend that agreement. So the real change happens when actually both sides feel like they've won. Now, it doesn't necessarily mean that every single part of what they were seeking to achieve in that conflict is acquired, but they realize that the relationship, which is now one of more trust, a beginning of mutual respect, and recognition of each other's needs, that's something that people can gain and build on going forward. And so exactly as you said, Aisha, when we come in convinced that the other person is wrong, that they simply don't have their facts right, we rarely succeed in transforming a conflict. And most often, we actually push people further apart.
And also just to kind of state the obvious, you know, we're not saying that the alternative is to condone these acts of violence. We're simply saying that we have to step into this dialogue from a place of compassion if we want the person we're having this dialogue with to actually be open enough to receive.
Yes, that's really true. And the kind of, you know, the examples that I've seen around the world are, you know, exactly that. I mean, I can recall many years ago, we were doing work in Indonesia. And we were working in 10 communities where there had been either violent attacks by extremist organizations, or there had been severe crackdown by the government trying to sort of eradicate that community of different individuals that were associated with the violent extremist groups. We knew that this was not about telling them what they weren't. What it was a whole program to enable these young people to explore the fullness of their identity, to look deeper within, to understand and expand their identity in a way that would help them see that the world was not black and white. There wasn't only the choice of saying, I'm for this violent extremist group that my aunts, my uncles, my neighbors may feel is a good choice, but that actually there's a lot of choices because within me, there are multiple identities. You know, one of the core principles with what we call the common ground approach is understanding the multiplicity of identities, how we inherit some, but we choose others, how our relationships amplify different parts of our identity, and how during conflict, things happen that give us the false impression that we're either one thing or the other. So when we talk about transforming and enabling people to make new choices, it's often about adding to the picture rather than trying to take it away and make people feel as though they only have one choice or the other.
One thing I'm curious to hear, especially about that story in Indonesia, is how did these radical groups manage to twist that definition of faith for these young people to something it wasn't? How can they believe that something they're explicitly told in their, you know, scripture is forbidden suddenly feels justifiable? Where do they get through there?
I think a lot of the insights that we had in working for many years with these pesantrens in Indonesia was an understanding that if we don't allow young people to explore the diversity and the fullness of their identity within Islam, and we did this through having them make their own documentary films about their identities. Can you be Muslim and play music? Can you be Muslim and also have some of your ethnic and tribal traditions that you value? And when we were able to use those tools, we created radio stations within the pesantrum so that, you know, young people could have conversations on air about different things, about the value of tolerance and diversity. This then enabled the narrative, which again was about black or white choices for people. So that if in the communities people were hearing that if you're a good Muslim, you have to support this group, then it narrowed the spectrum of choice that these young people could make. And the work that we did in filling out their perspective of what it really meant to be a Muslim enabled them to say, hold on, I can also be a good Muslim and not support that. Because otherwise, the use of shame, the use of fear, And the use of making people feel as though they are victims is tested over time as a way of mobilizing people behind a cause. And so if people are sensitive to a narrative that they are victims because of a narrow perspective of their identity, then, you know, we see this time and time again that people will line up behind a movement that's advocating violence and believe that it's the right thing to do.
That's really interesting. So it's almost like the social narrative and the threat of isolation that comes with that blinds them from actually understanding that the faith they ascribe to actually forbids the violence because they're so concerned about the fear of isolation. Am I hearing that correctly?
I think that the acceptance that people gain by joining in to movements that make it look like there is only one right choice is very, very strong. So I talked earlier about acceptance being one of those fundamental needs, and the opposite of that is isolation or being shamed or being ostracized, right? And so when we understand that people are social beings and that they are looking for acceptance, or they're looking for an opportunity to be celebrated, have their reputation augmented, then they absolutely are drawn to places where they feel they can become heroes. You know, one of the things that we've noticed with young people around the world, I was recently in Kenya, where we were working with young people along the Swahili coast. And if the Al-Shabaab narratives towards young people in that part of Kenya is such that these young people see themselves as victims in opposition to the Kenyan government, then what Al-Shabaab is bringing to them is an opportunity to stop being a victim, to imagine not being as poor, and to feel as though they can be heroes and that they can actually gain something. So that combination of being made to believe that one is a victim, having oftentimes real injustices put in a narrative of us versus them, can be very compelling for people to decide to make that choice and choose violence as an option to pursue what they need.
Mm-hmm. I once heard, I think this was when I first like started to realize that there was no profile. That was the moment I realized that we are all collectively responsible for any form of violence happening in the world. Because if it happens because of isolation or people feeling like they're not being heard, or like there's power that's been stripped away from them and they're being victimized, then each and every single one of us plays a role in shaping this global society that enables these issues to exist and continue to exist. And so I remember I was doing this research and trying to understand where have we gone wrong and how do we fix it. And there was a video where someone was talking about how when youth neo-Nazi groups are founded, they actually form camps that are literally like normal summer camps. So they play games and they get together by bonfires, and it feels like just getting together and building a community. And then the discourse around violence comes at a much later stage when they've been so enmeshed into the community that it becomes really difficult for them to then distinguish and sort of draw the line.
And, you know, one of the key insights that resonates with that story, Aisha, is that it's very often the same reasons that people are drawn into those movements that they're able to step out. And that is, again, a further reminder that, just as you said, we each have a potential power to try and change the course in our lives and in those around us. And when we recognize that people are drawn into these movements because they're looking for acceptance, they're wanting to have autonomy and agency and become heroes and feel like they're doing the right thing, then similarly, it's only through those similar kinds of connections that we can bring people into an off-ramp out of these movements. You know, my friend Arno Michaelis was the founder of what became the largest white power skinhead movement in the United States. And he often talks about how unsure he was about what really drew him to be so passionate about promoting white power. And, you know, he often describes it as sort of an accumulation of some frustration, you know, teenage woes, a bit of hatred, but also the sense of excitement about being a leader. And as he grew in that sense of being powerful as a leader promoting hatred, it was people who were ready to not respond to him with more hatred, who were not trying to simply respond to him with force or violence or security approaches, but who put out a hand to him of compassion that was then able to unpack and undo the hatred that justified his violence. And now Arno is also a leader. He's a leader with so many organizations helping people to bring others out of white extremism or other forms of violent extremism, working with parents and helping people to say, you know, it's not about a judgmental approach. It's not trying to tell people or scare them into making a new choice. It's really about using those tactics of love and compassion. You know, and Arno's story reminds me of so many people that I've met who were former members of armed groups across the many African countries that I visited, or people that were part of different violent extremist groups, or even people that were in gangs that actually are born leaders. And so if we try to take people who have a leadership experience in these armed groups and guide them into a situation where they won't be leaders, well, they won't want to take it, right? So it's also about how do we ignite the opportunity for more leadership, even if they're not part of those movements, as a way of helping people to make a new choice. You know, in the work that I do, I think it's very important to recognize that people who have been the victim of violent acts, it does require courage to connect and see the perpetrator of those acts as a human being who may have made those choices trying to serve their needs. But similarly, the people that have experienced that violence, they need enough space to also feel heard. You know, and two examples come to mind. At the end of the Nepal Civil War, many, many children had joined the Maoists by choice and by force. And there was a long period of having these young people extracted from the movement, demobilized, and then coming back to communities. And the communities themselves also needed that space to be able to feel heard, to feel as though their needs were being recognized. And from that place, it was easier for them to begin to have the empathy to understand, okay, these are young people, these are children, they've participated in horrific acts. Let me try and understand why, and let me see them again. It's about expanding that notion of who someone is and the multiple parts of their identity. Mm. Let me see them for more than just the act that they did that I've judged to be wrong. Let me try and see them for the full spectrum of their identities. And recently when I was in Nigeria as well last year, I was part of speaking with communities that were welcoming back young people that, again, by force or by choice, had ended up in Boko Haram. And it was hard for those communities to feel as though they should accept them, that they should understand. You know, they'd suffered at the hands of that violent group. But if you give it time as a peace builder, as a community change maker, and you recognize that both sides need that space to be heard, to be seen, to be respected, and allow the space to open rather than to close, that's where I actually have seen examples of reconciliation and healing and renewal of those relationships of trust and love.
That's beautiful. I love that as humans, because we're relational creatures and our brains actually have neurons that are called mirror neurons that literally mirror what the other is doing. What ends up happening in situations of conflict is that if we want the other to strip away the prejudice they have around us, then we need to be willing to do the same. And like you said, expand our definition of who they are and be able to see the multiplicity of their own identity as well. And I wonder if you could share some examples of this reconciliation, whether in Nepal or Nigeria or anywhere else where there's this inspiring story that shows us, because we always hear in the media about the conflict, but we never hear about the reconciliation and the hope that comes along with that.
Yeah. And I think it's because reconciliation is, on the one hand, it resonates so deeply with our human experience of recovery. But on the other hand, there is something in those stories of reconciliation that feels ambiguous. It feels unfinished. And I think it is oftentimes unfinished. But one of the places where I've seen reconciliation with my own eyes is, of course, Rwanda, which underwent a genocide, lost 1 million Rwandans in that 1994 genocide. You know, and some of the communities where my colleagues have been doing this work for many years have seen perpetrators committing to helping the families of the genocide victims, helping them to rebuild their homes, helping them in some of the chores. And just those simple acts of neighborliness can help people to see what it feels like and looks like to have a new relationship. I don't necessarily see a world where we no longer have people who hold different extremist groups. So I see a world where their ability to recruit and gain support is minimal, and where the governments and the state structures that are trying to combat them are not using military methods to do so. So what this means is that we would enable the communities where recruitment and support is mobilized to benefit from the kinds of transformative dialogue, relationship building, the different kinds of peace building activities that strengthen relationships across different dividing lines, that if we build those capacities within the communities that are most at risk of being recruited by these violent extremist groups, I believe that that will have the effect of taking the oxygen out of these extremist groups. You know, so in other words, I believe that we can get to a place where we're simply not enabling the conditions in which people decide to join those groups, mm-hmm. right? That's why it's a preventative approach. As opposed to trying to go and find every single person who holds an extremist view across the world and transform them. And it's not as though I don't believe they can be transformed, but I believe that the avenue is a different one. It's not always going right to those who hold the most extremist viewpoints. I have seen this over many, many years across the world. For example, in the Democratic Republic of Congo, where people have joined different ethnic aligned militia groups or violent student organizations that were promoting violence, that were able to change their allegiance to violent tactics because they saw it as ineffective without necessarily feeling as though they needed to stop being active, right? One of the critical things about our world today is that we do have injustice. People do have real grievances. The question is, how can we tackle those in a way that doesn't push us further apart and rather bring us closer together? So going back to, you know, some of the members of these groups in Eastern DRC, when they were able to see that, hold on, the scapegoating narrative that I've grown up with, blaming this other group as the cause of my poverty, of my marginalization, well, that's actually wrong. It enables me to then still work towards addressing that injustice and grievance, but not doing it in a way that seeks to eliminate the other group, right? So that transformation is really quite powerful because it helps people to make a choice to say, I'm not trying to fight to eliminate this other group. I'm trying to have a life of dignity, a healthy and safe and just society. Those are some of the important changes, which again comes back to recognizing that whenever we're looking to change people who've decided to get up and join one of these extremist groups, they have an incredible sense of self. They have enormous self-esteem that wants to be rewarded, that needs that encouragement. And so any shift needs to really take that into account so that their leadership and their agency can be expressed in other ways to tackle those grievances and injustice.
So what I'm hearing is that our collective responsibility as members of, you know, this global society is to, A, create communities of more inclusion, where people feel less marginalized, less left out, but then B, to also find ways to give people a sense of purpose and power so that they no longer feel helpless and unheard. Are there any other elements that are crucial for us to think of?
No, I think this is very true. And I think that the thing that we've also gotten wrong oftentimes when we've tried to tackle violent extremism is this idea that in a context where there are grievances and injustice, that you can simply take a very narrow approach and try and turn people away from a choice they've made, which they feel is justified in addressing those grievances and in addressing that injustice. And, you know, our radical responsibility as citizens is to ongoingly be involved in making a world where there is less injustice and doing so in a way that involves and includes everybody. And that in some ways is the most effective way for us to prevent further violent extremism in our communities near and far. The more we can be able to recognize and tackle the grievances and the problems together using, you know, inclusive dialogue and media, using different kinds of exchange visits so that people begin to see things from the other's perspective. All of these efforts can really help us to build a world where it will become less justified to say, I have no choice but to choose violence and to try and eliminate this particular group of people.
Mm-hmm. Or Matic, stepping out of our boxes and our comfort zones so that we can expand our own perceptions of how the world works and the options that are available.
And I think that, you know, one of the reasons why I use the word courage in my TED talk is because it's not easy. It can sometimes feel very wrong to seek out experiences that confront or contradict what we know to be true. And we often confuse empathy with acceptance and agreement. And it's not the same, actually. It's a choice we're making to understand what may have led to that person's perspective and beliefs and choices. It's almost like the ultimate generosity to say, I will stand and listen and learn who you are, what's made you reach the point in your life today. And I am giving you that sense of openness and understanding because I want to contribute to a better outcome. And what's the most astounding thing is that as we do that, it has an enormous effect on the other. It melts those walls and barriers and helps us begin to connect on all of those invisible points of connection that the violence blinded us from seeing.
And what I found especially empowering and what I find to be a source of that courage to also be willing to look is having a sense of deep trust in ourselves and our own values, and trusting that me being willing to, you know, empathetically look at that other person and understand what got them to where they are will in no way, shape, or form change my beliefs about what's right or wrong. Trusting that I can empathize and still completely find that behavior inexcusable, but also being able to see enough of that humanity in that person so that, like you said, we can bring the walls down and then we can find a way to communicate and say, well, how can we meet your needs otherwise? What are the alternatives?
If you think of it as a generous act, that might be one way to give you the strength to say, okay, I'm going to go into this room and I'm going to have to listen to viewpoints that I find abhorrent, morally reprehensible. Another space of strength, and this is one that I particularly find very compelling, is I see myself as a change maker. Waking up every day and wanting to try and make even a small amount of change in the world is my motivation. So as a change maker, if you're not able to understand what is making that person tick emotionally, spiritually, in their life experiences, well, then it's going to be very hard for you to be able to help them make a change. And so as an activist and as a change maker, choosing to be courageous and connect and having that empathy to ask why and wanting to help that person to change, it can be extraordinary. It can be exhilarating because you're feeling as though you're making some change. But of course, in the process, you become also a better change maker. You become a human being who has a wider perspective on life because you've been able to courageously step into that place of active listening, compassion, and empathy. And out of it, you still may decide that certain viewpoints that you hold are right, but you may also find that you're even more equipped to be able to drive the change that you seek in the world.
And I'm going to play bad cop here and reemphasize that in my personal belief, when we choose the comfort of looking away, which is a lot more comfortable than looking at this unfortunate reality of the state of things, but when we choose the comfort of looking away, we are part of the problem and we are complicit. And I know that's not the most comfortable thing to hear, but I really want to emphasize it because I think that the source of this problem and the reason people resort to violence in the first place is that they've had people look away. And when we continue to look away, we're simply reinforcing that.
Yeah, no, I would agree. And I would say that taking care of ourselves in the process so that we're also not taking on more than we can. I think one of the things that is important to be said also, Aisha, is that everyone does like to be right. And, you know, in the last 10 years, we've seen demonstrations around the world, you know, a huge participation by young people in demonstrating against something. And how we transform the energy of demonstrating against something towards building new relationships of collaboration to tackle the things that we find wrong around us, that's really what we're trying to get to. Taking the youth leaders and offering them another space for leadership through youth councils, through capacity building and youth leadership exchanges, and having them come face to face with the local authorities. We even at one point did mock government so that the young people could imagine what it felt like to actually run a municipality, right? And sense that, gosh, this is hard. There's tough choices that I need to make. All those ways that we can help people to step inside of other people's shoes will contribute and will make violence no longer a viable option. No longer a viable option because I don't want to harm the person whose humanity I now see. And also no longer a viable option because it's going to lead us towards a win-lose mentality, and that won't lead us towards a better world.
I want to reiterate three things that you mentioned today and that we kind of came back to, but that I feel are really important to sort of put in perspective for the listeners. And they're the three blind spots you talk about in conflict, which is one, that other people aren't like us in any way, and so creating those divides. Two, that it's okay to be righteous and judgmental and completely dismissing when others hold viewpoints or do things that are unacceptable in terms of our personal morals and values. And three, that we believe that there's a win and lose. And what you said so beautifully is most of the time we don't win. It's a transformation that happens. And what I love about this is that it's not just applicable to global conflict, but that this is something we can apply in relationships, one-on-one with everybody in our lives. In fact, that's a fantastic practicing ground that we can then use this to apply to more global scenarios. But what I'm wondering is, based on your extensive work in this field of conflict resolution, what opportunities lie in conflict?
I've always seen conflict as a welcome symptom that there's a problem somewhere that needs to be addressed. It means that somewhere in our community, in our society, someone has a real or perceived grievance, that there is people not feeling included, that there's people who are perhaps being brainwashed, that rumors are spreading and widening these dividing lines. So when the first signs of conflict emerge, it's for me an opportunity to say, hey, let's notice that, because I see it as something that's an opportunity for us to say, wow, let's go and try and narrow that dividing line. And in many of the countries around the world that I've worked, I've seen the symptoms of conflict be responded to as a challenge and a threat rather than an opportunity. And that's perhaps one of our biggest missed opportunities. And so when I talked about that third thing of making it okay to change without humiliation, it translates as true in that interpersonal space where you're wanting to accept someone and not humiliate them and say, you see how wrong you were, et cetera, et cetera. But it also translates into helping political leaders at all levels, right? Even our traditional and our religious leaders who exert so much authority in so many countries and communities, to be able to say, oh gosh, I didn't understand that well. Now I see. You know, recently I was looking back at our work in combating Ebola. And in 2018 and 2019 in Eastern Congo, there were many political leaders who were convinced that Ebola was a political conspiracy to disenfranchise that part of the country, which was an opposition stronghold. And many political leaders were directly or indirectly supporting the attacks on health and treatment centers because they felt as though this was in the best interest of their constituents and because it gave them a very powerful political platform. Now, they were clearly wrong because Ebola was a real disease. But the work of my colleagues and peace builders at that point in time was to try to open up conversations that could make the political leaders and their youth supporters feel reassured and gradually understand the facts of Ebola. And through discrete one-on-one small group homogeneous dialogue and then intergroup dialogue, we were able to make a transformation where both the youth supporters of these political parties and the political leaders were able to stand up and say, actually, let's fight Ebola. All they needed to do was to have the space to be able to make that shift and to make them feel as political leaders that they're not going to be losing their reputation, losing their constituents. And oftentimes I think we don't enable that kind of change. And that example in Eastern Congo was transformative. It saved lives. Those leaders still had a role to play in leading those communities on other issues around access to health and services and justice and the rest of it, but they needed to make that change. And that's where, if we had locked up all of those political leaders and taken a hard security force approach to them, it wouldn't have solved the situation. It was because we followed the steps of courage to connect, asking why, and helping people to change that that transformation was able to come about.
What is, maybe what stands out to you the most? Because I'm sure there are a lot of things, but what's a powerful lesson maybe that you've learned or gift of insight that you've received? What have these violence groups or individuals taught you?
One of the things that struck me when I've spoken to people who have chosen violence and then made a new choice is that they themselves have watched how they've become ready to use violence. They've watched their own ability to dehumanize the other. And in some instances, they've undertaken horrific acts of violence. And one can often ask the question, how can anyone like that come back into a place of needing human relationship? And yet that's what's been the most consistent thing that I've heard from people that have then made a new choice and have stopped supporting violence. It's that what they still want and need is a relationship of trust, of respect, where they feel as though they have a purpose in their life. And so no matter how far people go in terms of dehumanizing the other or dehumanizing themselves, because that's what committing violence does to ourselves, right? There is still a place that people reach where once again, the thing they most need, as you said very well, is those relationships, that acceptance, that love, that respect, and the sense that I'm influencing these relationships. No one really aspires to be a passive victim that is receiving humanitarian assistance and should sit there in a refugee camp receiving food. That is the aspiration of no one I've ever met. What people want, whether or not violence has been affected upon them, or they've chosen or been forced to use violence on the others, what they're looking for is, again, a set of healthy, safe, equitable relationships around them. And that is what transforms people. That's what gives them the exit ramp. And that's what enables them to come into a space of being human with other humans again. You know, one of the things I always identified with is this word Ubuntu in South African language, which says Umuntu, Ngumuntu, Ngabantu, which means a human is human through other people. It is what makes us human. And the experiences that I've seen of people who've made new choices, it just reminds me how true that is.
As you said that, it got me thinking of, I think it may have been Arnaud's story, actually, who you mentioned, who had a tattoo on his forearm of the organization he belonged to. And I believe he was in a store where he said he saw an African-American woman. So part of the community and part of society that was a target of a lot of the violent acts that his organization committed. And she looked at him and said, "This is not you." So instead of her labeling him as the perpetrator, she saw the human underneath that. And I love how years later he tells the story. And I think it was Arnaud. I can't remember because it was several people telling their stories, but it was so powerful that that stuck with him years later. And I wonder how much of a role she played in creating a shift for him. Because sometimes I think it could be, you know, the security person standing next to the mall's gate. And as we pass by, just acknowledging that there is a human being standing there and maybe making eye contact or smiling could be exactly what he needs.
I think that's true. And, you know, as I've seen communities work through and transform conflict and get into new relationships, it's not a straight line that moves at the same speed. You know, There are times when we need to put aside the things that divide us and just get together and play a good football game together, or plant crops together. There's times when we need to remind ourselves of what is our human experience, and then later come back to those beliefs and in some cases values, and in other instances, real grievances about what we think is being done rightly and wrongly. But that the contribution, and I've seen this so many times, the contribution of reminding ourselves of our shared humanity is enormous in that journey towards establishing new relationships. You know, and one of the things that I love that we do at Search for Common Ground is we use drama, television drama, radio drama, and of course live theater a lot. Because there are really moments, Aisha, when people have given up hope and it's impossible to see what it might look like when things change. And the evocative power of offering people vicarious experiences through drama and through theater is so powerful in reminding us deep down, yeah, actually, I do wish that I could feel safe going to the market. I do wish that, you know, this neighbor of mine that we could speak, I do wish that the security forces wouldn't treat us like this. And sometimes using these other approaches to get people out of that present moment of grief and helping them imagine a future that otherwise might seem impossible, very, very, very powerful.
I want to add one last question before we wrap it up. And I'm wondering, what gives you hope as we look ahead?
I think my greatest source of hope is not only the amount of change that I've seen in my life, but more and more the pattern of that change. So whether it's in different contexts, it's powerful and inspiring for me to see the similar ways that we change as we transform conflict and renew and ignite healthy and safe relationships and communities. That gives me a lot of hope that if I also see that the community of peace builders and conflict transformation practitioners is more sophisticated than ever before. There's thousands of universities and colleges where people study this. The evidence of what works and what doesn't work is freely available, whether they're studying psychology or social sciences or security studies. The ability of people to learn those lessons and integrate them into all of these different sectors where we work, I think is extraordinary. And more, you know, even in today's world with COVID-19, I see many doctors, scientists, health workers, humanitarian organizations recognizing that the kinds of things we've talked about in terms of bringing assistance to communities that may be divided, the way that we need to understand who is included or not in the way that we ignite an all of society approach towards tackling COVID-19, these are insights that I feel we won't lose and that we've gained over the last 30 years. So it doesn't mean that I'm not impatient. As I mentioned earlier, I'm impatient, I'm in a hurry. I want us to be able to have a multi-stakeholder approach towards finding ways to tackle conflict without violence. But I believe that what we've learned about how change happens, how conflict can be transformed and violence no longer be a viable option, I believe those insights are with us to stay.
Thank you so much, Lina, for sharing such generous insights with all of us. For anyone who wants to know more about this work or maybe wants to get in touch with you, how can they best do that?
I encourage people to look at sfcg.org, Search for Common Ground, and you're happy to, as well, to put my email address in the show notes. Perfect. If anyone would like to reach me directly.
All right. Thank you so much.